You're listening to Honestly Mental, the podcast, and I'm your host, Erica Diaz. I'm a wife, a mama, a woman in leadership, but y'all, I'm a perfectly imperfect human. I have depression, PTSD, and generalized anxiety disorder, and I am figuring it out every single day. It's really been quite the journey, so this podcast aims to provide a raw and authentic approach to several issues surrounding mental health. Through the lens of our guests and I, we will provide insight into how we navigated our own challenges through honest and vulnerable conversation. We are building a community of individuals committed to changing the world, one conversation, one person at a time. We are raising awareness by destigmatizing mental health through continuing the conversation. We are providing hope and ultimately have a goal of saving the lives of those who may be feeling dark and alone. Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Honestly Mental, the podcast. And joining us today, I'm so excited to have Mickey Pelletier join us to talk about challenging the status quo as it relates to stigmas and men's mental health. So Mickey has spent the past 17 years in a professional work setting focusing on contingent workforce management. Having worked globally for large companies and clients, he's become an expert in the space. In 2023, he formed his own consulting company to help buyers and providers optimize their contingent workforce solutions. However, despite these successes, he has also struggled with anxiety, depression, and OCD throughout his life. These difficulties have impacted his career, relationships, and family. And he's faced the stigmas often associated with being a man with mental health issues. But through the years of work, he's begun to change the way of thinking and behaving to better manage the symptoms associated with these struggles. And for that, welcome, Mickey. I'm so thrilled that you're here.
Hey, Erica, thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here, and thanks for having me part of this.
Yeah, and obviously I am a female, so I cannot speak to the challenges that men may face other than being aware of what happens out there. And in fact, over 6 million men suffer from depression per year, but oftentimes male depression goes undiagnosed, and the stats say that nearly 1 in 10 men experience some form of depression or anxiety, but less than half seek treatment. So we're here today to tackle some of those stigmas, and you are sharing from your standpoint as a male about how important it is to have emotions, feel your emotions, and that it really shouldn't be any different from a female going through the same thing, right? So Mickey, I would love for you to share a little bit about why you're here sharing your story and your journey.
Yeah, I mean, so to me, I mean, mental health is, you know, something that's been a part of my life, and, you know, I'll share my journey, you know, in a minute here, but you know, it's something I've always been the type to ask for help, and maybe I'm different than some men. I mean, I have no problem walking into Home Depot and finding an associate and saying, hey, where is XYZ? Why? Because I want to get in and out. I want to move on. I don't want to waste time trying to find things. I don't know if it's swallowing my pride or just, you know, the pragmatic side of me that just wants to be done and move on with my day. So the same thing, you know, applies to, you know, my life in mental health. There's been things of my life that have been bigger than me that I believe something isn't right. Something's not wrong. And just like if I needed something was wrong with my car and I couldn't fix it to myself, I couldn't fix it, you know, on my own by myself, I would take it to somebody that's an expert in the space. And same thing applies with mental health. I don't know how to fix my brain. I don't know how to change the wiring. I can't control that. And, you know, I am what I am, and I'm dealing with what I was dealt, and the way I process my emotions, you know, may be different than others. And so I've taken the time to get help. So I don't know. I'm happy to share a little bit about my journey in mental health as well. It was a childhood.
Absolutely. Appreciate the vulnerability too, Mickey. That's obviously in the vein of this podcast, is being honest and transparent and vulnerable. So thank you in advance for that.
I think the title says it all, honestly mental. And yeah, there is a vulnerability. There is, putting something out there to the public. You know, there are people that I work with and professionals that are going to listen to this and may judge me a little bit differently, but you know, it's good to have context and history of a person. And if this changes the way people think about me or feel about me, well, that's on them, because I am who I am, and my past has shaped me, and it makes me into what I consider to be the wonderful, amazing person I am today. But it's taken a while to get there. And so, you know, I mean, growing up, I had, you know, bouts of sadness in childhood, you know, sometimes unexplained, sometimes, you know, pretty normal. You know, my parents did divorce when I was a child, and there was some trauma in the events that happened during that time. And, you know, during college, you know, there was, you know, some other traumatic events that I had experienced, and a fair amount of depression that went with it, and actually sought help from the school therapist, and, you know, found some, you know, some good, I don't know, say relief or sort of validation there of the things I was struggling with, and said, okay, this is great. And again, when I say trauma, you know, there's different types of trauma, and everybody's trauma is relative to themselves. You have your big capital T traumas, your little T traumas, you know, and it's all relative to you. And I don't ever want to come across as a pity party and anything like that, but it's important to share my journey. And I think that's part of, you know, the stigma here is being able to share your vulnerabilities and where you're at. So I wanted to pause and just acknowledge that, because that gets into a little bit more of my story. So, you know, I graduate college, I get my first big boy corporate job down in Virginia. I'm so cool living out on my own. You know, but shortly, like quickly after starting my job, really struggled with anxiety and depression. There was, you know, this dread of going to work and managing the work and managing a relationship and transitioning from college life and questioning, is this what I'm going to do for the next 40 years of my life? And just that being very debilitating, really struggling with anxiety every day and just being bummed out and sad every day. Some days better than others, but so I saw a doctor and ended up going on the medication citalopram, and actually life got better. I started to make friends. I started to figure out how work was, what I was doing in my job. I was also self-medicating on the side, but life was going better. I eventually ended up moving to Seattle, and life was really good there. I was traveling all over the world with my job, and then ended up going to work in Singapore for a few months. And that's when my anxiety really started to come back with a little bit of a vengeance. Possibly it was the medications weren't working. Possibly it was because I was not able to self-medicate when I was abroad. I came back to the States and I still struggled with anxiety. Work was much harder. It seemed so difficult to get through the days. I was really faking it to make it day in, day out, and continuing to self-medicate, and nothing was helping. So I continued, I started seeing a therapist again. I switched meds over to a combination of Effexor and I think Wellbutrin. At that time, I also met my woman that would end up becoming my wife. I ended up switching jobs and moving back across the country. Then life was good again. Anxiety was mostly gone. Depression was still there, but everything was really manageable. And for about 5 years, rode that wave. Everything lasted and I was feeling good, but I started to question continuing on medication. I didn't like the side effects. I was wanting to sleep all the time, had odd twitches in my body, night sweats, weight gain, and was just really worried about that dependency on medicine. So I started seeing a therapist again to try to help me regulate and process things in my life. And eventually, after a year of talking to them, decided I would go off that medications. I started tapering. That took me about a year and felt pretty good coming off the meds. Halfway through the taper, actually felt my creativity start to come back and was surprised at how good I felt. And so I said, yeah, let's keep going. I eventually came off the meds in August of 2017. While I was off of prescription medication, I did continue to self-medicate on the side, but not as much. It just wasn't helping me feel as good. Then I remember it was on 9/11 of 2017, had a really bad panic attack and just really freaked out. I didn't end up going to the hospital or anything, but because I kind of knew what was happening just from past experiences. And so from that point, I actually stopped, I think it was a panic attack caused from self-medication. So I stopped that and I stopped caffeine. So within a month's span, came off three, you know, things that I was putting into my body that can really alter the way I'm thinking about things and altering my mental health. So at that point, I'm completely, you know, drug-free in my body, facing life on life's terms. And that was hard. It was a very hellish time in my life. I consistently felt on edge, anxiety filled all the time, always worried, you know, always on the verge of panicking. And it was debilitating. Work was hard. And I started questioning if coming off the meds was really right for me. I continued seeing a therapist. And this helped me continue to manage those symptoms. And things slowly got better over the next year, but it took a long time. And, you know, in 2018, 2019, I ended up starting a new job and I felt better, but eventually the honeymoon was over and the anxiety came back, but with different symptoms now. Now I was feeling heart palpitations, odd sensations in my chest pains, the type of stuff that scares you and sends you to, you know, the doctor. I ended up seeing a doctor. They declare that it's just anxiety and stress. Everything's looking good. And those symptoms have still come and go depending on my stress levels and anxiety levels to this day. So I've continued seeing a therapist, and over the past 2 years, I was actually diagnosed with OCD, as something that I'm continuing to work on, that myself and my psychologist have worked through, and have through that, I've learned root causes, how to manage and handle the OCD, and actually found great success of that through, just through exposure therapy and things that, you know, I had some root causes that deep down were, you know, triggering to me. And so that's something I still work on between the OCD and the anxiety. So here I am, 2024. I still continue to see a therapist. I think, Erica, before we even started the call, I told you I was just saw my therapist earlier today. And now my focus is really on balance in my life of being a father, being a husband, running my own business, owning a home, but balancing that with managing the stress, the anxiety, the OCD, just the symptoms that come with it. And some days are harder than others. So that's hopefully not too long-winded, but that's my journey of, you know, gone through, you know, being on medication for about 10 years and then have now been off of medication for going on 6 years now. So, but still continuing to see therapy, and that is still a very important part of my life and part of my, you know, mental health fitness.
Yeah. And, you know, your journey is so compelling to me. I think, you know, you talked about medication management, and while, you know, depression, anxiety, OCD, all of those diagnoses that you've received, that I've received, that you've received at home, right? Those are likely lifelong scenarios in many cases. But the medication component is really something that is a lever that can be pulled on your own individual journey. And so I think that it's neat that you've highlighted that as part of your way that you balance the stresses and anxieties and, you know, how the physical manifestations of those diagnoses come up. Because while, you know, things are probably not going to change as it relates to having depression, anxiety, and OCD, the medication component isn't a lifelong sentence, and everybody has the ability to be as involved as they would like to be in that piece of it. And, yeah, you know, dang, the medication journey is just that, quite a journey. It takes, you know, gosh, 6 to 8 weeks before you feel the full effects of one medication. Yeah. You know, they don't always work for one person to the next. And it really feels like some crazy mad science about behind what your magical cocktail is of these different pharmaceutical drugs that can, you know, help you out and balance the chemicals in your brain and all of that, right? So I just think that it's important that you know that that piece of your mental health journey is unique to you. And it looks so different from person to person.
Yeah, so, I think, yeah, no, I just want to comment on that. That's such a great piece, because like the medication was an early lever that I pulled and it worked. It did great, you know, but there was side effects and things that I, in the long term, didn't like. And so I wanted to try living life on life's terms. And man, was that hard for a long time. And things have gotten better. But yeah, is that a lever I may need to pull in the future? Perhaps. Yeah, for now, I personally, I don't want to go back on the medication. But for others, it works well, and it is what they need to be on, whether that is long term or short term. I mean, call it a crutch, call it whatever you want. It's no different than a diabetic requiring insulin, you know, for their body to be able to process sugars and metabolize the way it could. It's just the way of that our brains, you know, whether that's a chemical imbalance or a wiring, whether that's nature or nurture, you know, the jury's still out. There's very varying, you know, research, but you have to find what works for you. And I think to your point, that cocktail of drugs and what works for you is, you know, is, it can be, you know, something that you have to work through with the licensed professional that does that. And then not only the prescribed drugs, but anything you're doing recreationally outside of that also has an impact on the, you know, the working, the ability for the prescription drugs to do their job. Your own, you know, exercise and your well-being, your diet outside of that has an impact as well. So I think that's maybe one of the difficult things, is there's all these components that tie into just you wanting to feel happy.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think that's everyone's goal, is ultimately to have a good, fulfilling life where you are happy and less stressed. And, you know, when you're balancing fighting depression every day, that can be quite the challenge. You know, I want to get into just your experience with the stigma surrounding mental health with men. So, you know, like, it's one of those things that we hear all the time. Men don't talk about their feelings. Real men don't talk about their feelings, or just, you know, you should just man up and deal with it type of thing. So how have those stigmas societally, you know, shaped how you ultimately either sought out help, which you said you don't have an issue doing, or, you know, just how you've even been in a place to talk about your own mental health journey? How have the stigmas impacted that?
Yeah, it's, don't be a baby. Come on, Alice, pull it together. Yes. Come on, man up, figure it out, pull it together. You're fine. You're fine.
You're weak if you have emotions and show that
you're weak. Don't cry. Don't be a baby. It's, you know, I think there's these generational pressures, these societal pressures. You know, I think that, you know, I'm a millennial. Say, stigmatize, stereotype me as you want, but you know, I think there was generations above us that, you know, that there was that suppression of emotion. There was no validation of emotion. There was no, you know, real conveyance of emotion. You know, you went to your mom if you're feeling, you didn't really talk about it with your father. That wasn't a fault of your father's, nothing that he did wrong, but that's likely how he was raised. So I think there's this generational gap in terms of, you know, needing to break a cycle of this generational suppression of emotion and validation of emotions that I think is so important. For me, you know, as an adult and a father now, everything I'm doing in my life is to break that cycle so I can be a better father, so my daughters don't have the same issues that I did. They feel good speaking about their emotions. They, you know, can process that. They don't need to go seek mental help. Or if they do need to go seek mental help, they can do it confidently and know that it's the right thing to do. So I've changed sort of my approach to it, you know, why I've wanted to break that stigma. Because to me, like I said in the beginning, I have no problem asking for help. And maybe that's just me. And maybe I'm lucky because I'm okay. And am I weak for that? Hell no. I want something done now. I'm a product of, you know, maybe my generation, but I want that instant gratification. I want to be done. I want things to be quick. I want to feel better now. I don't want to be crying. I don't want to just feel that pit in my stomach of anxiety that's debilitating, and I can't think straight. I can't work. I can't get things done. I can't live a happy, fulfilling life. I want to go get help. So to me, breaking that stigma, you know, it's just maybe something that happened naturally to me. But it's not something I talk about. I have rarely shared in very small, tight-knit circles that I've ever sought mental health support, mental health therapy. Like I think I've maybe shared with my father, and I did so, you know, worried that there'd be judgment, or, you know, that I'd get teased or anything like that, because that's what happens. There's always ribbing. You know, it's like, oh, you're taking medication. You know, like that could be a response you get. Like, oh, what are you going to the loony bin? What are you, crazy? You know, what's your problem? You know, and there's this perception that every other man, every other person has it together. You know, before talking to you, Erica, very vulnerably, would have never known you suffered from any of the experiences, any of the traumas, any of the, you know, consequences in the day-to-day mental health struggle that can exist for you. I never would have known that. But talking with you has been so refreshing and validating, because I know I'm not alone. And yeah, maybe it's a man to a woman. We do have these shared struggles. And maybe it's more acceptable for a woman to be able to say, hey, I'm feeling sad, or this bothers me. Or with a man, you know, there's those societal pressures that you're a provider. You don't feel, you just do. You just go about your day, you work through it. You know, times will be hard, but you move on. And I know for me, it was, I don't want to do that. Something's wrong and I want to fix it. And if someone's going to call me a baby or something negative, or think that I'm weak, then that's fine. That's your opinion. I think it's not a weakness. It's a strength that I'm willing to seek help and make a change in my life. No different than I would go to a doctor if something wasn't right with my physical health. So I think that's sort of the, I don't want to say a guiding principle, but my thought through it. And early on, it was very much an independent solo struggle. I shared with my girlfriend, you know, who would become my wife, you know, what I was going through. You know, but outside of that, the vulnerability and the transparency of, you know, what I was experiencing was very limited for, you know, anyone else besides, you know, her and I. And, you know, because there is that fear of, what are people going to think of me? What's my perception going to be? Could people trust me with their work? You know, yeah. For me to be their consultant, you know, this guy's crazy. Where it's like, no, I'm actually very competent and confident that I know if I need help, I'll go get help. So I think it's, you know, I think the spin is, don't be a baby, see a therapist, get help.
Yeah.
Man up, go get help.
There you go. That's a way to spin it, right? And gosh, isn't it so funny how, maybe funny isn't the right word, but it's crazy to me, the generational traumas that have occurred or different things that have happened generationally, as you've mentioned, and the suppression of emotions. But then you have your own children and you're like, oh no, like you just do not want to repeat some of the same, you don't want to repeat history, you know? And so, we're in this age where, there's a lot of information out there, right? We're in the age of information. I was just on another podcast where that was mentioned, and it can be information overload, especially as a parent, but the drive and the catalyst to continue the conversation about mental health is not only for us in the present, but also for our children as they are growing up, so that hopefully we can provide them a guide with, you know, why focusing on your mental health is important and why seeking out that help if required is not a sign of weakness. I just know for me that once I became a mom, so much of that was brought into focus.
We want better for our children, right? I think that's one of the things you don't think about until you're a mother or a father is, oh my gosh, I have this little person that's dependent upon me, and they're just this little vulnerable thing. And then you see them start to grow and develop and have their own personality. They're talking, walking, forming opinions. And you think of your own experience and you think, my God, I don't ever want them to have to go through that. So how can I protect them from it? But maybe if I can't protect them, how can I enable them to better, progress, in process these types of experiences? Because odds are my children are going to feel depressed sometimes. They're going to feel anxious sometimes. That's human nature. We can't avoid those emotions. So how do I enable them to better process those and work through those emotions and acknowledge that they are real and that they will pass? And here's some tips and tricks. That's something my wife and I have talked about when we were thinking about having kids, is I worried about passing on the anxiety and depression. And, my wife was very, pragmatic and practical about it. She's like, there is that risk. That's possible. But you know what? They have someone to talk to in you, because you have that experience and you can share with them what you've learned and be able to help them, because there was like this selfish thing of like, oh, well, I don't want to have kids because I don't want to pass that on to them, and I don't want them to feel that. So I should just not have kids. Right. But that's, that shouldn't prevent me from having a family and doing the things that I want to do, because having children was something I wanted to do. And it comes back to we want to make our children's lives better than our own. So how do we take these struggles, these lessons learned from ourselves, and turn that into realistic things to help them as they mature and go through life? And I mean, my daughters are 3.5 and 1.5 right now. So they certainly have a long way to go. And they're in the throes of processing basic emotions right now. The biggest struggles are, I don't like that we're not having chicken nuggets for dinner. And I'm able to work with that, right? It's not... Yes. But I worry about the future of social media and bullying and the types of things that we see in today's society when they're a little bit older. How is that going to be? And how am I going to be there to support them and help them? And I don't want to say protect them, but arm them with the information they need to be able to successfully manage the emotions and mitigate the risks that come with these stressors that happen in life, so that when the big stress, the even bigger stressors as we progress in life come on, they're better equipped to handle them more effectively with less drastic, consequences. I think this is how I think of it.
Yeah. Giving them a toolbox of ways to handle mental health. And obviously we all wish and hope that, they don't have to go through formal diagnoses or things of that nature, because who would want that for their kiddos? But it can happen. It's part of being a human. And some are more predispositioned than others to, whether it's genetics, as you've talked about, or environmental circumstances. Some may be more at risk than others, but at the end of the day, as a parent, I know that, it's a goal of mine to leave behind a toolbox to where they feel comfortable talking about mental health. And we're doing that today by, again, continuing the conversation. I think it's so critical that we bring light to these issues, because that in of itself is leading by example for our children and dispelling the myths around, weakness as it is associated with men and showing emotion and their feelings. You talked a bit about some of the shared struggles between men and women. And I know, obviously we actually have kiddos around the same age. So I have a 3-year-old too, and they have big feelings. Let me just say that. So there are certainly ways, even now, they have a long ways to go.
They do. Everything's a big deal. Everything's a big deal.
Not only is the argument over chicken nuggets, but it's more because the chicken nugget isn't shaped like a dinosaur like they want, right? Or something along those lines. And it's just, you know, catastrophic. But all that to say, those are each of those opportunities where they're feeling big emotions is an opportunity for us to help guide them and make sure it's okay. But anyway, all that to say, we also, you and I, experienced a layoff. And, you know, I'm curious from your perspective as a man, how that impacted you. Cause I know for me, I was pissed. My first emotion was anger. I've talked about this quite a bit already on throughout my episodes, but you know, I feel like that was probably more acceptable. And, you know, there, you see women and different things putting themselves out there, say on LinkedIn or other social media platforms and whatnot, and saying, you know, they're open to work with the big green banner. That is vulnerable in of itself too. So I would love to hear from you how the layoff impacted you. And then if there were stigmas that played into how you, quote unquote, you can't see my air quotes here, but should have reacted.
Yeah, the layoff piece is it's so prevalent, you know. So we're in early 2024 for those listeners that are listening in the year 2027, years from now. You know, layoffs are very prevalent, particularly in the tech space, but we're, you know, seeing it all, a lot within, you know, recruiting, talent acquisition, HR functions, as well as companies are downsizing and, you know, whatever reasons they give. It's hard not to be pissed. I mean, that was one of my initial reactions. Just so frustrated. I mean, I was out on parental leave. You know, my daughter was, you know, a month or two old when this happened. You know, and I thought I was protected. You know, FMLA is going to protect me, but no, it doesn't. It doesn't protect you. You could still be laid off. You know, there was women I spoke to that had just given birth, you know, weeks before, that were laid off. So no, you're not protected. And so yeah, it was very much pissed off, very frustrated. Just how could you mismanage, you know, this many people, mismanage your business so much that you have to lay off tens of thousands of people, you know, and how could you do that to people? And, you know, it's humiliating. I'm not worthy. You know, they had to cut the riffraff, and I was part of that riffraff. There's just right away this immediate negative association to, you know, not being worthy, not being good enough. That's, and it becomes very personal, even though these decisions are made on a very non-personal level, but to you, it is very personal. Your work is part of your livelihood. It's part of your identity. And when you just get cut off from that, you know, from an email at 6 a.m. on some, you know, idle Wednesday morning, it's devastating. It's frustrating. You know, I was humiliated. That had never happened before. I was, you know, and I published some articles about my layoff experience that details a little bit more, but it's, man, did that amp up my anxiety. I was experiencing heart palpitations at the time due to just, you know, ongoing anxiety that I had, becoming a second time father, and, you know, stressors there and elsewhere in life. But man, this really amped up my anxiety, because it's, you know, I'm the provider. You know, granted, my wife works, she's a better worker than me, and, you know, but as a male, I'm the provider. I need to have a consistent job. And boy, I look silly now that I've been laid off. What am I gonna do? And, you know, what are we going to do about health insurance? And, you know, where's the next job going to come from? And I can't take a pay cut because I'm making so much and I've earned this and that. There's these stigmas, these stereotypes that, you know, I don't know that they necessarily, you know, they transcend more than just me being a male. I mean, certainly, as, you know, there's the, you know, societal pressure of, you know, being a provider, you know, which I think we're, you know, our generation and below are doing a good idea of, are doing a good job of remembering that doesn't have to be the case. But yeah, just that lack of just a feeling of, you know, unworthiness, you know, and then wondering like, geez, I've been laid off. Do people think I'm not good enough?
Yeah.
Am I going to be good enough for my next job? And
I remember feeling that too. That was that. it took such a toll on like your self-worth, and it was insane. I just, you know, how are you able to express the emotions that you felt? You know, I'm sure it went into even sadness at times, and, you know, it's the grief cycle. It oftentimes that's associated with loss of life, but in reality, this was a loss. So,
oh yeah.
Given, there's, you know, societal pressures and whatnot, how did you outwardly cope with your emotions as a man?
Yeah, no, there's definitely like a grieving process that you have to go through. I mean, like I said, part of your livelihood, your identity that's just cut and it's gone. It doesn't exist. So man, that there's going to be some grief and some grieving that you need to experience, that you need to do to process. I mean, I remember when it happened, you know, we were actually on a little road trip. So we were on leave and trying to use the most of that and would spend time with family. And we're on a road trip down to South Carolina. And I think I woke up at 6 a.m. I got an email. We were in some hotel, and, you know, the one daughter's crying, the other one's waking up and being like, we got to just get our day going. I couldn't just sit there and pout or anything. And eventually we get, you know, in the car going and trying to figure out what to do, trying to get more information, messaging people on LinkedIn. And then I see other people, you know, sharing that they had been laid off. And so, I mean, the first sort of outward thing I did was I made a post on LinkedIn that I was frustrated and, you know, disappointed, but, you know, excited for the future, you know, a few sort of, you know, hackneyed cliche things that we unfortunately see more often than we should. And not that I like thanked my employer for the time there, because I was bitter. I was pissed off. Like, why did they do this? So I think that was like my first outward thing. And I was okay doing that. I was okay being vulnerable, because it was I need to get some air covers. You know, I need to let people know that I'm available and get the word out. And if I don't publicize this, nobody's going to know. You know, how else am I going to get connected? And there was an outpouring of support and this and that. And, you know, some of it superficial, some of it people just looking for their next, you know, salesperson, you know, some of it for people just looking for me to share my contacts and get them in at companies from my past. And that being a whole thing. I mean, I think the other thing was sharing with family what I had gone through. I think one of the first sort of emotional outpourings was we were on the road and sending my father a text that I had been laid off. And, you know, I don't even know why I sent the text, but I needed to get something out. And after hitting send, you know, pulling over on the side of the road and bawling like a baby, call me a baby if you want, but man, those tears just started flowing. Cause it was like, this is what my body needs to process. And I need to grieve and I need to get these emotions out, cause I need to get through my day. I need to go through. And, you know, my wife hugs me and you cry it out for 5 to 10 minutes and you feel a little better. It doesn't right the wrong of what I'm experiencing, but man, that outpouring of emotion, it could be cathartic. It can, make the rest of the day a little bit more difficult, but
there's nothing wrong with crying.
No. And
I think there's nothing wrong with it. Right.
I love a good movie or a good story that can bring you to tears because it's so relatable and evokes that emotion. And I think it's perfectly fine. Granted, I'm not always like proud to share that I've done that because there is a stigma. I don't want other men to think I'm a baby. I don't want, you know, other people to think I'm just this emotional guy, but you know what? I am. I have emotions. I'm a real human, and that's okay. I wear my heart on my sleeve. I think I do it responsibly. I don't go to my clients and air my dirty laundry, you know, and start bawling to them. But I think at the right time and place, you know, I'm happy to share my emotions and vulnerabilities, and being laid off was certainly something that evokes and brings about, you know, difficult emotions. You know, when you're separated from something that you've been a part of for a long time, like I said numerous times, that's a part of your identity. That's a lot. That can be devastating. And some other people, maybe they process it well, and that's awesome. We all handle our emotions differently, and that's sort of the thing. So for the men that are listening, that, you know, are vulnerable and maybe have more difficulty processing their emotions, like that's okay. And there's opportunities to, you'll be able to express those and learn how to express those in a way that in the end, at the end, is going to make you better.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's, I'm glad that, you know, in recent times, this is becoming a topic of discussion, because we've got to break down the barriers to mental health in general, and then, you know, tackling the societal pressures and stigmas, male or female, around mental health really need to stop. And the only way that's going to happen is by having people like you, Mickey, being vulnerable and sharing their stories and not hiding, you know, in the dark alone, with those thoughts, feelings, and anything that may be coming up for you. So I think getting the message out there that emotions, everybody has them, and they don't discriminate just because you're male. And, you know, so it's one of those things that I feel very fortunate to have this platform and guests like you who are committed to breaking those stigmas and challenging the status quo as surrounding mental health.
I think it's so important that I keep using the analogy of, you know, something wrong with your car or your home, or maybe your health, you'll go in and get help. And I think we're all starting to realize that mental health is just another one of those components that, you know, can utilize, you know, some expert neutral counsel, and being able to talk to somebody that doesn't necessarily have a vested interest in you. They don't know you personally. You know, their job is to just work, you know, help you work through, you know, these emotions and these, you know, turbulent times that you may be experiencing. And I think that's awesome. We're moving towards that. But, you know, as a group, you know, as men, you know, as people in general, we need to be more accepting that that is an okay thing to work through. Obviously we know emotions are fine, and the way we experiencing those and express those are there, and we need to be more vulnerable there. But, you know, the vulnerability to seek out that help, you know, goes a long way. It's I don't know, maybe it's exercising your mental muscle. Like, you need to, just like you would go to a physical therapist, you know, if you need to, you know, fix a particular muscle or, you know, part of your body. This is, you know, there's a mental therapist is just there to help you, you know, exercise your brain and think about things a little bit differently and process them in a way that, you know, maybe your own upbringing, your own genetics, you know, hasn't allowed.
Yeah. So. And, you know, it's really truly a problem such that it creates other implications that, you know, people should be aware of. So there's a lot in the statistics around mental health, and we talked about already how less than half of men seek treatment, but what does that do to suicide rates? You know, in 2021 alone, the suicide rate for males was approximately 4 times higher than that of the rate of females. And, you know, think about that. When you look at the population, males make up about 50% of the population. But yet males also make up nearly 80% of all suicides. And that is, you know, a result of, in my opinion, of the societal stigmas and challenges many of us face that have mental health issues, is not seeking help for one reason or the other because you don't want to be viewed as weak, or whatever thought is in your head that's causing you to retract from outwardly seeking help. So we've just got to continue the conversation and shed light on all of these issues, because, you know, the downstream implications are loss of life. And Mickey, for example, you listening at home or in your car, you are enough. and you are worthy regardless of the circumstances that you may be in. So it could be experiencing a loss like a layoff. It could be a different type of loss, like, you know, losing a family member or a loved one, you know, but there are these challenges that everybody's going through. And the goal is to live that happy, fulfilling life and being able to manage and mitigate your emotions through the challenging times.
There's a quote from a book called Oathbringer. It's part of this fictional fantasy fiction series called The Stormlight Archive. And in it, there's a character that, you know, goes through his own struggles and depressions and whatnot. And he talks about, you know, his journey. You know, and he writes his own story, and he gets to this quote where he says, you know, the most important words a man can say are, "I will do better." And I think whether that's a man or a woman, you know, I will do better. You know, I'm going to have my stumbles, my trials, my falls, and I'm going to learn, but I will do better. Whether that's for yourself, whether that's for your children, your wife, your husband, your family, your friends, I will do better. And to me, that's powerful. And I think of my own mental health journey, I will do better. I'm going to get help because I need to be better for myself and for those around me. And so, you know, if suicidal ideation is part of where you're at right now, you can do better, and you will do better. And that starts by getting help. And that's scary. Well, you're in a scary place right now, but it can be better. And I think that's, you have to be willing to make that change to be better and not become this terribly morbid statistic.
Yeah. And it's probably worth mentioning, you know, that there are several options for getting free and confidential emotional support. And, you know, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, you can call or text 988. And there is somebody available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They also have a chat function. And there's the National Alliance on Mental Health. And their number is 1-800-950-6264 or 1-800-950-NAMI. And so I think highlighting those resources for anyone who may be in the thick of it is something that I wanted to share. Mickey, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your journey and the stigmas surrounding men's mental health. And, you know, I appreciate those of you who have joined and listened in. So thank you, Mickey, for being a guest.
Yeah, thanks, Erica, for having me. And yeah, everybody, don't be a baby. Get some help. Get some support.
Yes. All right. And at this stage, you know what to do. Please subscribe, follow, rate the podcast. It's how we continue to get the message out there. Take care.